So as Barbara mentioned, just got back from a family trip to Southeast Asia. We went to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. And Jerry and Laura Simpkins were along with us. And Mary and our daughter and her sister and various others. There were 10 of us. And every time I go to Asia, I come back and just feel like, I don't know what is going on. We always hear about how this tradition of meditation came to us from Asia. Of course, the Buddha lived in northern India. It soon spread to other countries around Asia and eventually over here, right? And in that process, as it went from country to country, it takes on its own unique form. So Vietnam, because of its proximity to China, sort of has a different flavor. It's more of a Mahayana flavor to its Buddhism. Cambodia, it was, in my experience, it was more like an archaeological trip. It wasn't as alive as it is in Thailand, or in India, for that matter. I did have a sweet encounter with one Cambodian monk. He went walking by me, and one thing I really wanted to do this time in Asia was to give alms to a monk on the street. So he went by me, and I didn't think I had any money with me. And then I realized I did. So I stopped, I turned around, I went running after him and flagged him down, stood in front of him and bowed and took out the money and gave it to him. And he gave me this little mala. Mm-hmm. It was really sweet. So this kind of reminds me of generosity. Not that generous, though. I realized I'd given him 1,000 riels, Cambodian riels. I realized afterwards that's worth 25 cents. So I got a real bargain on the mala. But Thailand is quite alive. Buddhism is quite alive. And it is also quite, at least from what I read, what they practice there is quite close to the way that we practice here. So Ajahn Chah, who's one of the main Asian teachers that was the source of, teaching to Jack Kornfield and the folks at IMS, is a Thai forest tradition. Now, what we found in the temples in Thailand was this amazing mishmash. Thai Buddhism, at least in the architecture and the iconography of the temples, is quite strongly influenced by Hindu teachings. So you see Garudas over the doors, you see four-faced Hindu gods in the place, the little shrine where you'd expect to find a Buddha statue. It was quite disorienting to me. And so I thought, well, what is this all about? Well, finally we got to Chiang Mai, which is a lot calmer than Bangkok. And Jerry found a little temple west of town where they were offering daylongs for foreigners. And so we attended. It was all in English. This young 29-year-old monk who had seen his teacher offering teachings to foreigners, and they were several days long. And he noticed that a lot of people couldn't stay that long. So he decided to offer daylongs. He asked his teacher permission. And this young man would travel 22 kilometers all the way to this other temple. It wasn't his home temple, to offer these teachings to foreigners. His teaching was so clear and so consistent with the way we practice here that I thought, okay, somewhere underneath all of this glitz and these gold stupas and these gold-colored Buddhas and these Garudas and Vishnus and Brahmins and all that, through all of that, the teaching is surviving somehow. That it's really continuing, because this young guy, I mean, he's only 29 years old, been practicing about the same length of time as Jerry and me. Wonderful teaching, just fantastic. And the way they were delivered, not just the content, but, you know, the way they were delivered, very humbly, very clearly, it was inspiring. It was really great. So, you know, again, every time I go to Asia, it's like, I have no idea what's going on. And, you know, it's not a bad attitude to have. So it's kind of good to get shaken up every once in a while, and nothing like a trip to Asia to do that. Mm-hmm. So I came back from this trip. The first trip I went to was in 2007 to Asia. And it was on the Buddhist pilgrimage track, you know, with Sim. And we went to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened. We went to Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. We went to Kushinagara, where he died, where he experienced parinibbana. And very inspiring. I mean, to see Buddhists from all over the world paying tribute to this amazing human being who really tapped his own potential and then decided to share that with all of us was very, very inspiring. So I came back from that trip, and I'm a Buddhist. That's it. You know, no more questions. I'm definitely a Buddhist. And, you know, time goes on, and you live in this society, and you see all kinds of things around you. And then going back on this trip, I thought, well, what's that even mean? What's it even mean to be a Buddhist? I mean, you see folks there in Asia that, you know, for generations, I mean, think about it, going back to the Buddha, that's something on the order of, what, 900 generations or so. They've been Buddhists. Been Buddhists that whole time. And what are they doing? Well, I mean, some places are not practicing at all. In other places, I was just talking with somebody at the break, in Thailand, you're walking in this modern city, Bangkok, and then you come around a corner, there's a courtyard in front of a bank. Here's all the bank employees, all dressed up in their black suits and their ties and their, you know, business formal dress outside of this bank, offering alms to the monks. They have these tables set up, they have these big fancy baskets that are wrapped in clear plastic stuff, and they go around and they pick up, you know, all of their offerings. It's part of their daily life, part of their business life. So, you know, and then in the temples, you see people doing what appears to be worship. And the way this young monk explained it to us when we asked him, what are those people doing worshiping the Buddha? He said, no, that's not worship. That's offering respect, which, as we know from recent events, is a much more highly held value in Asia than it is here. Offering respect isn't something that we do a lot of in this culture. But they do it, you know, for their elders, and they do it for the Buddha. And some of the practices over there kind of are a mishmash of those two. Offering, you know, respect and honor to the elders, the ancestors, and then to the Buddha. So, again, I was confused, and what does it really mean to even be a Buddhist? So I've been sort of contemplating that in the couple of weeks that I've been back, and I'd like to explore it with you tonight. Let's start with a question. Is Buddhism even a religion? Well, it certainly is for millions of people in the world, in Asia, and for our ethnic brothers and sisters here in Sacramento that have brought their religion with them when they came here as immigrants. Here's a quote from the Dalai Lama. This is his Nobel evening address in 1989. From one viewpoint, Buddhism is a religion. From another viewpoint, Buddhism is a science of mind and not a religion. Buddhism can be a bridge between these two sides. So we know that the Dalai Lama has these conferences when he has scientists talk to Buddhist teachers and kind of exploring the bridge between those two worlds. Probably one of the best known Buddhist atheists, that's the title of one of his books, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, is Stephen Batchelor, a British teacher and scholar. He says, I cannot think of a single practice from any other world religion that could be utilized outside a religious setting in the way mindfulness is being used today. This leads one to wonder whether, in its essence, what we call Buddhism is best described as a religion at all. So I have come to the conclusion, doesn't mean that any of you have to follow this, but I've come to the conclusion that Buddhism is not my religion. I don't view it as a religion. What it is, we'll talk about. So I was raised Catholic, and so just like the Buddhists here have their generations going back and back and back all the way to the Buddha. My ancestors via Spain and Ireland have generations going back and back and back and back and back. Not quite to Jesus Christ, but well on the way there. And so someone asked, again, the Dalai Lama, whether we should convert to Buddhism. Once we take on this practice, should we convert to Buddhism? Is that something we should do? He said, I don't want to convert people to Buddhism. All major religions, when understood properly, have the same potential for good. Essentially what he was saying was that Buddhism isn't something that you should take on to become a better person. You should take on the practices to become a better whatever you are. You know, we're all human, to become better humans. And then beyond that, if you have some other religious identity, don't feel like you have to change that to become a Buddhist and to benefit from Buddhist practices. What if I don't have any religion at all? Any religious leanings? Can I still benefit from these practices? I raised that question on Monday with the Rockland Sangha, and one of their participants surprised me with his answer. He says, I'm a Buddhist, and Buddhism is not a religion for me. So, you know, I tend to be sort of black and white, yes and no, this or that, in my thinking. And I thought, well, there you go. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. You could call yourself a Buddhist, but you don't necessarily even have to adopt it as a religion. So that's certainly an option. Stephen Batchelor says, those who adopt Buddhist ideas, values, and practices today in the West are not necessarily interested in joining another religious institution. They find the Buddha's test it and see approach to be perfectly compatible with a healthy skepticism. And I've talked with some of you. You've got very healthy skepticism working for you. This was actually in a letter, an open letter to the Dalai Lama after the Dalai Lama declared that you don't have to convert to Buddhism. So he's writing back to the Dalai Lama. The name of the letter is, What's Wrong with Conversion, Your Holiness? It's funny coming from Batchelor, right? If one interprets the Dalai Lama's advice as an encouragement for Westerners to remain within their own secular traditions, then atheists and agnostics may be reassured to find the non-theistic and self-reliant approach of Buddhism to be broadly in keeping with their own outlook. At the same time, Buddhism may also be enabled to recover its own critical and pragmatic perspective, which historically has often been overshadowed by its having assumed the identity of a religious creed. So this is Batchelor the skeptic, the agnostic, saying, actually, Buddhism I've heard him use in other contexts the word encrusted with religious things growing on it. You know, sort of like those Buddhas in Asia that have all of these. I mean, you go behind some of the Buddhas in the temples in Asia, and you'll find all of these little Buddhas hiding behind it, sometimes still in their original wrappings. And we ask the monks about that, and they say, well, we can't. Someone wants to donate something to us. And those of you involved in the SDC can appreciate this. Someone wants to donate something to us. We can't turn it down. So we accept them, and then we sort of, you know, hide them behind the other Buddha. So these encrustations, for those who are uncomfortable with religion, in a way, maybe have affected Buddhism, but certainly affects our view toward Buddhism as a practice. Stephen Batchelor, again, in his essay, The Secularization of Mindfulness. A secular Buddhist celebrates the adoption of mindfulness in non-religious settings, while recognizing that for its potential to be fully realized, a meditative practice alone is insufficient. So he's addressing this question of McMindfulness, right? The one-fold path. Mindfulness taken out of its context in the Eightfold Path, taken out of its context of ethics, of dana, of sila, of all of those other parts of Buddhist life that inform our practice. And he's saying that's not enough. So he's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. He's saying, for its potential to be fully realized, a meditative practice alone is insufficient. Just as Jon Kabat-Zinn and others have secularized Buddhist mindfulness, the challenge now, and this was written just a few years ago, is to secularize Buddhist ethics and philosophy in such a way that they can address the current conditions of our world by articulating a way of life in which humans and other beings can flourish together on this earth. What a timely statement. Secularize Buddhist ethics and philosophy in such a way that they can address the current conditions of our world by articulating a way of life in which humans and other beings can flourish together on this earth. Now, let's take this one step further just to be provocative. Mm-hmm. And the question that I came up with was, can I study the teachings of the Buddha without even calling myself a Buddhist? So for our first stab at that question, we're going to turn to Gil Fronsdal, who's a wonderful teacher in both the Zen and Vipassana traditions down at IMC in Redwood City. And his latest book is called The Buddha Before Buddhism. So as we know, Jesus Christ was not a Christian. He was a Jew, right? The Buddha was not a Buddhist. He taught before Buddhism. And this particular volume, Wisdom from the Early Teachings, is a translation of the Atthakavaga, the Book of Eights, which is thought to be one of the Buddha's earliest teachings. And here's what Gil has to say about that. To arouse interest in the translation of one of the oldest surviving Buddhist texts, I decided to call this book The Buddha Before Buddhism. I hope this title would raise a number of questions. These Buddhists are so good at coming up with questions, aren't they? I hope this title would raise a number of questions. Most prominently, what might the Buddha have taught after his awakening, but before he and others organized and systematized his teachings into what is now identified as Buddhism? What may be perplexing to many is that the Book of Eights does not espouse a religious doctrine that exists in opposition to other doctrines, nor does it put forth a teaching that is meant to be seen as superior to other teachings. In a manner that challenges the religious beliefs of many people, including many Buddhists, the text explicitly denies the role of ultimate religious truth and knowledge in attaining personal peace. And just spoiler alert, what it does is it just looks at the practices. What would we do? Not what would we believe, but what would we do to become a person at peace, to become a sage? Another person who has a pretty good grasp of the teachings is Joseph Goldstein, co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, who, by the way, was a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand. That's how he encountered the teachings. He says this in this wonderful book, One Dharma. The Buddha did not teach Buddhism. He taught the Dharma, a Sanskrit word meaning the truth, the way of things, the natural laws of mind and body. He taught the truth of suffering and its causes, the end of suffering and its path. In 84,000 discourses, a classical number used to mean a lot, the Buddha expounded in both simple and subtle ways the profound meaning of the Dharma. So we've talked about this movement from Asia to the United States, Western Europe. And, you know, my joke about that is that as each country has encountered, or as Buddhism has encountered cultures, various cultures in each of its countries, it takes on a new form. In Tibet, it merged with the Bon religion, which is where you get these fantastic monsters and, you know, like the critter that's holding the wheel of life back there is actually a Bon monster. They existed before Buddhism came there. You know, in Thailand, again, it encountered both Hinduism, which is the second major influence on it. I mean, they mostly practice Theravadan, but then it sort of encountered this echo from China and Japan of the Mahayana tradition. It's really interesting. You know, Buddhism swept through Thailand, went into China, went across to Japan, and then sort of echoed back. So there's this echo of Mahayana as kind of a third influence with Thai Buddhism. My joke is that when it came to the United States, it adopted the religion of psychology. And, you know, many of the leading people that first brought it over here were psychologists. Jack Kornfield, Jack Engler, you know, they were psychologists. Sylvia Boorstein. It's sort of taken its own form in this country partly in response to that. Let's see what Joseph has to say about Western Buddhism. We are living in remarkable times. A genuine Western Buddhism is now taking birth. Its defining characteristic is neither an elaborate philosophical system nor an attachment to any particular sectarian viewpoint. Rather, it is a simple pragmatism that harkens back to the Buddha himself. Just what Gill was saying in his book. This pragmatism that harkens back to the Buddha himself, who pointedly questioned the established tenets of ancient Indian thought. It is an allegiance to a very simple question: what works? What works to free the mind from suffering? What works to engender a heart of compassion? What works to awaken? Thing I want to read out of here. So Joseph's tenet in this book, One Dharma, is that not only is Western Buddhism emerging as its own form, but this is a place where various forms of Buddhism can encounter each other, where they wouldn't in Asia. You know, you wouldn't, I mean, even though there were pilgrims in ancient times that came from China to India on pilgrimage, you wouldn't necessarily have Zen Buddhists having a dialogue with a Thai forest monk, but whereas in this country they can. Here's some funny examples of that in here that I'll leave for another time. The implications of one dharma for both Buddhism and our own culture are enormous. A wise cross-fertilization of spiritual practices can only deepen and broaden our understanding. It will foster not only tolerance, but also genuine respect, there's that word again, respect and unity, as we each find from the great treasure house of Dharma those teachings that benefit both ourselves and others. One Dharma is, of course, in the very, very beginning stages. Someone once asked an Asian teacher what Western Buddhism will be like. He replied, "We'll know in a couple of hundred years." So, you know, the Asian countries have had a couple of thousand years to develop their forms. We've had, what, something on the order of 70? And the modern centers that we think of as the sources of our form of practice, IMS and Spirit Rock, have been around for about 40. We're just babies. Joseph says, a new mantra began to emerge in my practice as he pondered how there could be a one dharma, and it was a very truthful response to the conflicts that had been plaguing me. Who knows? You know? And that's a really great question to always keep asking ourselves. Who knows? So what does all this really mean for practice? And the reason I ask that question is that I think it's important to have a framework of how you hold your practice, why you're practicing, what your sources are, where you turn when you're confused. And it's also important not to hold that too tightly, because this practice is embodied. We learn, we obtain insight by studying our own mind and body, not by holding on to some tight concept of what we should be doing. So a healthy practice is always going to be asking questions, and it's always going to be operating from direct experience, not from conceptualization. But it is very helpful to have a container to understand what's happening in practice. So this one sentence from Joseph. After we have become established in one tradition, we can then learn from others. Understanding that at the heart of them all, there is a common ground that supports our journey to freedom. I think this sentence is particularly applicable to folks that have chosen SIM as their practice community. We have available to us in the West countless Buddhist teachers, you know, living, dead, local, in other countries, today, yesterday, 15 years ago. You know, you can listen to talks from Kamala and Steve from 15, 20 years ago if you want. With all of that mishmash, it's really important, as Joseph says, to become established in one tradition. It's very helpful. The way Steve Armstrong, my teacher, puts it, is that it's really great to have available to us the breadth of Buddhist teachings, but at some point the searcher needs to find something and actually go deep with something. So the breadth is helpful, but depth is what's going to set us free. And I love this this sentence from Joseph about what this actually means for our practice. In the one dharma of emerging Western Buddhism, the method is mindfulness. The expression is compassion. The essence is wisdom. So the method is mindfulness. The tool that we're using to explore our own minds and bodies, to explore what it means to be fully human, to try to figure out if we can apply this practice in our daily lives, the tool for all of that is mindfulness. The expression, the natural outpouring, that happens when we apply mindfulness, when we're actually aware in our daily activities and in our formal meditations, the expression that naturally arises out of that is compassion. Okay. And, you know, compassion in the Buddhist sense of a true caring and concern without attachment for the suffering of others, for ourselves and others. Because we need to feel a compassion toward ourselves, particularly in the West, where many of us have this very strong self-critic. So we need to broaden that sense of compassion to be inclusive of ourselves and our own not yet enlightened habits. The essence is wisdom. So how do you practice? Are you seeking wisdom in your practice? Are you seeking the essence? Are you seeking comfort? The way that you practice, the container that you hold it in, will determine how and why you practice. Is wisdom the essence of how you practice? Don't know. It's a good question to hold. Okay. Now I need to just give one other viewpoint. And that is good old Bhikkhu Bodhi. We need some Theravadan orthodoxy here. Because Bhikkhu Bodhi is continually warning us about the buffet, what Reverend Bob at the opening called the buffet of Buddhism that's available to us here in the West. So just to pay him tribute, not saying I believe every word, but to pay Bhikkhu Bodhi tribute, because we owe so much to him for his translations. Let me read you his take on the Kalama Sutta. Partly in reaction to dogmatic religion, partly in subservience to the reigning paradigm of objective scientific knowledge, it has become fashionable to hold, by appeal to the Kalama Sutta, that the Buddha's teaching dispenses with faith and formulated doctrine and asks us to accept only what we can personally verify. This interpretation of the sutta, however, forgets that the advice the Buddha gave to the Kalamas was contingent upon the understanding that they were not yet prepared to place faith in him and his doctrine. It also forgets that the sutta omits for that very reason all mention of right view and of the entire perspective that opens up when right view is acquired. So you get that? I mean, remember the Kalamas were the Marin County of the Buddha's time. They had every teacher in the world passing through, so they're very confused. And they came to the Buddha and they said, "We've got all these teachers passing through. What do we do?" And he said, I think I have the exact quote here. He said, "When you yourselves know these things are good, blameless, praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter on and abide in them." In other words, personally verified in your own experience. What Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying is that he wouldn't have taught that way. As we know, the Buddha taught very specifically to every audience that he encountered. Whether you believe that he could read their minds or not, he could understand their cultural context. If a Brahmin came to him, he would use the words Brahmin. He would use the words the three fires. He would use terms that they could understand to teach to them. So when he talked to the Kalamas, he understood that they were at this crossroads of all of those teachings that were floating around India at that time, and that they weren't Buddhists. They were some very confused folks that were trying to figure out how to believe what they were hearing. So Bhikkhu Bodhi's point is a valid one. They didn't have right view yet. All of us, to some extent, having heard a few teachings, have some inkling of right view. So maybe we can rely on some other things other than just our own personal experience. Okay, enough. So I would like to hear from anyone that is courageous enough to articulate it or has put some thought into it about how you view Buddhism, in air quotes for the folks that are listening to the recording, Buddhism in your life, Is it a religion? Is it a spiritual practice, which I think I've come to for me? I think I'm not quite sure what my religion is, but my spiritual practice is Buddhist practice, and not just on the cushion. I mean, I really get what Stephen Batchelor is saying, that we need more than just sitting on the cushion 15 minutes every morning to really benefit from this practice and to have it, our lives, be a benefit to others as a result of our practice. We need much more than that. So, you know, I do my best to understand the teachings, to embody those, and to try to find some wisdom and compassion. So, anyone, how does this inquiry strike you? Does it raise some questions, confusion, objections? Inspire faith? What have we got? Yes?
I see it more like a way of life than a religion. And Thich Nhat Hanh call it a practice, not a religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just following the precepts and the full path. I mean, it's such a, I hate to use the word pure, but it's just such a pure path and such a good lifestyle, a way of life. You know, I see it more like a way of life.
Way of life. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Yes?
You know, I was drawn into mindfulness practice because I was a licensed clinical social worker.
Uh-huh.
And I did dialectical behavior therapy, and it resonated very much with me, and it was very effective with clients, even clients who had trouble understanding some other things, you know. It just kind of gets to the core of things with people. And so right now I'm on the cusp of exploring more, because I'm going to the beginning class soon, and I've been coming to Sim for about 8 months, but I've had the benefit of Jerry's wisdom over the past 13 years, so I've gotten some stuff by osmosis. But, you know, for me, it's like being on the first step of a new path in a way, because it's drawn me in to come regularly in a way that I hadn't quite expected. I kind of expected to keep it at a distance a little bit and just accept it from a, this is interesting intellectually place. So right now I'm in a very different place, and especially since our trip. And I appreciated our monk who led the day long that we went to, Prav KK, called it a philosophy and not a religion. He said, Buddhism is a philosophy. It's not a religion. And I really appreciated that perspective, because I'm still an Episcopalian. and I honor that, and I cherish that. But this augments rather than detracts from that. And it's nice to hear that kind of validated here today, because it's not something I want to give up in the course of my exploration. So
Well, I think about the piece of religion that I've always found troubling is the blind faith aspect. The chance that me as a mere human could never really validate the things that I learned as a child, being a pretty run-of-the-mill kind of Christian. But I find that faith as part of my Buddhist practice is about opening my mind to possibilities, and because I've seen how consistent the practice hangs together, even the parts that I personally do not have verification of yet, I've seen people that have verified those things for themselves, and I trust the practice the more I do it. So the trust piece is there. And I tell people that I practice Buddhism most of the time. I say it's my religion if I want to, like, do conscientious objector kind of things, you know, like serve on particular jury trials, you know, and things like that I just don't feel comfortable doing ethically. But it feels like it is a package. The teachings in all the different areas feel very consistent. Mm-hmm. And they don't just feel consistent in the mind.
Yeah.
They feel consistent in the whole self, in the body, in the spirit. And what I find really trippy about it is that I don't think I have to label it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does feel like it's a path of becoming human. And I don't know why spiritual has to be separate from mundane at this point. You know, I mean, they just all seem like we draw these distinctions.
Right.
And it's fascinating to me to watch that break down in my own practice.
Yeah, you know? Body separate from mind?
Yeah.
No, you know, once you start practicing, you realize that's artificial. Yeah, good. Thank you. Yes?
Something you said earlier about focusing on what we would do.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, you stole my quote about how I love it. And if you want to have fun, next time you're in a hospital or one of those places that wants to know your religion, point kindness. All that object stuff. Kind of two things for me. I always say I don't want to call myself a Buddhist because I don't want to give people like you a bad name. And this is my first time being here. There's kind of two ways I hold it, but my practice, I guess. One is I hold things as true. I don't believe in anything that is true. So I don't know how that works with Dharma, finding true. I hold things. What I do hold as true is a couple things in terms of a lot of it would be labeled existentialism, that we're mortal, there's impermanence, constant change, everything's connected to everything else. And for me, seems as if we can benefit from how to hold that or sit with it. Mm-hmm. And so I really like one of your quotes that talked about what works. Mm-hmm. I think how do we go from philosophy to what works,
mm-hmm. right.
in this world. So there's a pragmatism to that. And I really like the heart being kindness, what was just shared.
Yeah.
And it's right now kindness it's a challenge, and because there's a lot not working, it seems, and one of the questions I'm living with right now, and I always like living with questions, is if we were to take this assumption of kindness, how do we bring our kindness into the world when the well-being of others requires resistance, rebellion, and revolution? Mm-hmm. And I personally feel like I owe it to my grandchild to live in that question.
Thank you. Yes.
Piggybacking on the previous commenter said, I am by training a philosopher. That's what I have my degree in. And what kind of, in my mind, when I think about religion, I define it as the dogma that is passed down from the person who actually had the experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you look at all the major religions in the world, there is a person who had an experience, mm-hmm. and he tried to convey that to other people, and then it was systematized and dogmatized so that it could be solidified for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, I don't really consider Buddhism a religion. However, and I'm quick to not call myself a Buddhist, and that's principally because the majority of people who claim to be Buddhists don't actually practice meditation. So in that respect, I have trouble calling myself a Buddhist. And then one last thing is that I've noticed, and this is just something that came up for me when you were speaking, was that I've noticed that in this country, it seems like the Buddhist path is really focused on that seventh of the eightfold path, whereas maybe in the Thai forest tradition, for example, they put a lot of emphasis on the eightfold path. And that is where, from my experience and from what I've seen, is where the experience actually comes from. So there's a little bit of concern for me with the secularization of Buddhism, because it almost seems to be taking out the very core of what allows people to not claim it as a religion, but actually claim it as a direct experience. So I just...
I was very interested when you, that brief section where you talked about Buddhism and a connection to science, because it's actually through science that I came to Buddhism. When I was in college, we were sitting around in a dorm room, and it was more than once, and we were talking about quantum mechanics, and eventually came up Buddhism reflected, or quantum mechanics reflected Buddhism, back and forth, and how it seemed like there was a compatibility, at least to me. And eventually, I went and I became a practitioner of Zen, first Japanese Zen, and then Chinese Zen. And then eventually I set up, you know, some years after graduation and all that, I said, heck, I'm a Western man, I gotta get a job. plus I also, like Laura, I am an Episcopalian, and probably will be until the day I die, even if I stop attending church. But when I was exposed to Jerry, mainly, to this group, I was very interested in the fact that this group was following the oldest tradition that we know of, the Pali. So I said, you know, let's get back to the origins here. For me, it's all about an inquiry. Maybe it's a learning philosophy. Maybe it can encompass science. It can encompass mysteries of other faiths. But for me, it's an ongoing, unfolding understanding of what I experience and then also trying to understand what other people are experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
I come from a different tradition, but I started out in philosophy. my work really centered around the question of how do we figure out what is good and how do we bring it into existence? So that was an immensely difficult problem. That was during the Vietnam War, and there's a lot of confusion in religion about how to respond to war. Some teachers would say, go fight the war. You know, others would say, no, it's not good. So the thing that attracted me to Buddhism was this issue of knowing, how to know the good, and how to keep the good in the way. And so after a while, I started the Zen and other things, but I think the thing that got me most interested and developed me the most was the use of the very things that really I don't think this particular branch of Buddhism uses much. And that is very like the tankas. Tankas are deeply encoded philosophies of how to be, deeply. And the problem is we don't see them. We see them as, I hate to use this, but you look at the history of art, and most of the art that we see these days is shaped by bourgeois class, either buying it or perceiving it. I mean, it's an art object. And so, like a bell, a danta, that in Tibetan Buddhism, what is that? You know, the feminine. Or you can just go on and on with these instruments, and they're quite old. And you spend a little time looking at what they reveal, and what they reveal is a way of knowing. Very, very directly. Just pop, there it is. So the difficulty that I have, being a Western guy, is, darn, this is a new thing. It's a bell, obviously. So how can it reveal any way of seeing? And that's the task, to see. And so I think my practice has really focused around improving my ability to see. And so I enjoy you guys and come here because it's very structured. Whereas my core practice is not. And so that's a wonderful play. I appreciate that much, and it grows me up. So I encourage people to, if they have any interest, to delve into these objects and see what they are. And, you know, anyway, that's my practice.
Thank you.
I wanted to follow up on some of my philosopher in the room that I feel compelled to give a shout out for religion, with the caveat that, again, it depends on how you define it, because first of all, I want to acknowledge that my background is Christian and all got a big mixture, a big bag of eclectic Protestant denominations that we visited with my mom when I was young. My mom would take my brother and me around. And I remember one Pentecostal church where they said, you know, Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And they didn't see themselves as a religion, but I sure did. And for me, the word religion has a negative connotation of dogma, of rules, of judgmental and expectations of having faith in things you can't verify. Very negative. But the term itself means something you do on a regular basis, religiously. You do it over and over and over, doing it. And I want to make sure I don't necessarily rush to judgment to someone who says Buddhism is my religion, in the sense that it's something that they're doing on a regular basis, over and over, consistently, because it's something that they hold dear. So, just wanted to throw that out.
Thank you.
Building on that, you know, in my own life, I don't so much refer to Buddhism or call myself a Buddhist, just because the word has the sense of subscribing to some kind of set of tenets, especially cosmological tenets. And similarly, in my own life, I don't hold Buddhist practice or the practice of Dharma as religion. But I've been very moved by some teachers that I really respect who will talk just very matter-of-factly about the religious life in the context of Buddhist practice, where what they're talking about is not necessarily the handed-down dogma piece at all, but the idea that it's a really different life activity, it's a really different stance on life to put something that's not our separate grasping self front and center stage in our lives and our decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us are really doing that. So even though for me, just culturally, I will tend not to use the word religion about my practice, it also resonates when I hear it talked about in that way. And I think that's part of what you maybe were alluding to also.
Thank you.
I just wrote somebody, Kathy Savannah, on Facebook, where she's going to speak at spiritual church that I, you know, she said she was talking about who, was that teacher, Roshi?
Suzuki Roshi?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was saying, well, I'm a Buddhist too, but then I'm thinking I'm going to Buddhist meetings and I practice because it gains wisdom to me more mentally than in a religious standpoint, because I say I'm a Buddhist because of the kindness here and so many good-hearted people I met and the openness, and it shows you how to have integrity. But then, in fact, I still believe in God. You know, to me, that's faith, whatever God is. There is a God up there, even though it looks gruesome here and whatever happens, you know, in the news. I still believe in God. You know, it's just like, I will say I pray to God. You know, I can't worship a statue, even though I believe in Buddhism. I value Buddhism. I will, you know, pray to a monk or bow to a monk, but I won't worship statues. It's just so, I don't know how you define a religion. To me, it helps me mentally. It clears my mind. I mean, when I'm meditating, I can have more of a Buddhist perspective of things. It gives me more clarity of mind, Buddhism, than Judaism or Christianity, which is really more confusion than guilt. It gives me more guilt, which is not good. And Buddhism gives me an awareness of clarity. So I don't know, to say a religion to me, I don't know what it means. You know, it's like a dichotomy. I don't know if you could have two religions if they, you know, cross connect. So, you know, I don't know. It goes into theory how people view religion. So all I know is how it is for me.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people don't accept it, and sometimes they do.
Right. Thank you.
A very admirable man that I know from India was talking to me about how Hinduism, the term Hinduism was, I'll try to explain what he said, was put on a set of spiritual practices from the outside. And I have encountered definitely some Indian spiritual practices that see Buddhism as part of what they do. So basically they see that the Buddha was one of the incarnations of God or prophets or wonderful teachers that enriched what came before and after, if that makes sense. And I would like to hear how you see that, whether you see Buddhism, I like the air quotes, Buddhism as part of or a subset of Hinduism.
Well, I mean, when I was in India on that first pilgrimage, certainly the Hindu people there explained it exactly as you did, that their tent is wide enough to include Buddhism and that they're very happy to accept the Buddha, either as, like you say, one of their gods or one of their prophets or as a teacher. My personal view of it is that it's sort of certainly the religious environment of the day, with the Vedas and those Brahmanic practices at the time of the Buddha, became something that others put the term Hinduism on. And then the teachings of the Buddha became something else that other people put the term Buddhism on. Mm-hmm. So I kind of view them more as like sisters, because a whole bunch of things that we don't have time to go into tonight, but there are the slight differences, and it's one of these deals where the same word is used for two different things, mm-hmm. and then two different concepts are the same thing with different words. So it gets kind of confusing to parse them apart, but personally, my own belief system, I guess you'd call it, the view that I'm clinging to right now, is that Buddhism actually is a separate tradition from Hinduism, even though the Hindus I've talked to in India have said, mm-hmm. yeah, we accept the Buddha as one of our gods, teachers, whatever. So
I view it. I found for me it's a way to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Being without a creed, without a dogma, without engaging with with the divinity, and I've only been involved in this way for about 3 years now. But in recent months, and I'm seeing it more simply. I was making it more complicated and complex than it was. Well, mm-hmm. I'm not getting.
Yeah, always helps to come back to basics. I have one last one here.
Favorite passage of mine from Adyashanti starts with the line, "Awakening is a destructive process," which sounds harsh but really rings true to me. To me, this practice and this path is letting go, mm-hmm. and abandoning of the things that caused me to suffer.
Thank you. Yeah, others have phrased it that similar idea as Vipassana is a constant process of grief. Mm-hmm. Letting go, grieving that, moving on. Great, well thanks to all of you for your participation. I'm going to finish with this last quote from Stephen Batchelor. He talks about the simile of the elephant. You know how all the people go up to the elephant, the blind people, and one feels the tail and says, oh, it's a rope, and one feels the ear and says, it's a giant leaf and whatever. He says the Dharma is the whole elephant. Dharma practice exposes the limits of human thought and language when we are confronted with the puzzle of being here at all. All people, whether devoutly religious or avowedly secular, share this sense of unknowing, wonder, and perplexity. This is where we all begin. And may I add, this is hopefully where we can all stay. And that wonder, unknowing, and perplexity. So let's close tonight with bringing into awareness all those in this world who are suffering. There's no shortage of calls for our compassion and our wisdom in the world today. and bringing to mind the recollection that all beings, just like ourselves, want to be happy. May we wish for all beings that they be safe and protected, peaceful and happy, as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. And may all beings everywhere be free from suffering.